All right, let's get started. Good afternoon, everyone. Looks like we have a little bit of feedback on the microphone. You guys hearing that back there? All good? All right. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Exchange Server and Exchange Online Tips and Tricks session. Slightly different title from the way we advertised it in the catalog. The catalog title was marketing's idea. I had nothing to do with putting my name in the title or adding the word live onto the end. In fact, I've always delivered this live. It's never been a recording. So I don't know why they came up with that, but they were having some fun, and so that's what it is. But I'm glad you could all make it. Let's take a quick show and see who we have in the room. How many of you are running only Exchange Online? Okay, how many of you are running Exchange 2016 on-prem? All right, 2013 on-prem. Wow, 2010 on-prem. All right, 2007 on-prem. No, hands are still going up. Anybody with 2003 want to throw your hand up? All right, no. Okay, so it looks like the majority of you are running 2013, which is great, but we are going to focus a lot on 2016 and on Exchange Online, so hopefully once you get to either of those destinations, you'll find this stuff pretty helpful for you. So let's just dive right in. And how many of you have not seen one of these tips and tricks presentations before, specifically this Exchange one? Okay, so let me set the stage for you. So generally, when I put one of these decks together, it's usually to accomplish two things. One is to give you a level set, which is the basics, which we're going to go into soon, so that everybody understands where we are with Exchange, what's happening with Exchange, and so forth. And then we're going to go through a bunch of different areas, some related to high availability, some related to transport, some related to things that you need to watch out for, and some related to just various things that are typically in the community or buzzing around in the Exchange sphere, if you will, for a while. So to start out, let's talk a little bit about how we deliver innovation in Exchange Server, because the way in which we did it a few versions ago, for example, for those of you running 2010, is pretty different from how we're doing it today. We still, of course, are shipping the on-premises product, so we still have 2013 and now 2016, which has actually been out for more than a year. But the way in which we develop it is very different from the cadence that we used to have previously. Previously, a typical developer, when we were done with one version, they would be working on specs for features and changes in the next version, and that would all go through a whole bunch of processes that ultimately resulted in a feature getting in the product. But typically there was a 3-year product cycle, so it could be anywhere from 3 to 4 years before the developer actually got feedback on their feature and found out if it was actually useful for customers out in the wild. So the way we do things now is pretty different in that we're not developing for the on-premises product directly. Rather, we develop for the cloud-based product, in this case Exchange Online, and we have a very fast approach that we take to it. We can innovate very rapidly and introduce new features. In fact, we're doing that almost on a constant basis, not just with Exchange, but all across Office 365. And then what we do is we'll get feedback, very quick feedback on the usefulness of a feature. We'll be able to refine it, enhance it, and whatnot. And then when it comes time, we will collect in code all the enhancements, all the features, everything that we think would be a benefit for on-premises deployments, and we'll package that up and ship that as either a major release of Exchange Server or a cumulative update or service pack to an Exchange Server. So, most of you, it looked like we're on 2013, so hopefully everyone is familiar with the difference between a cumulative update and a service pack. Some of you may be running earlier versions of Exchange where you're used to us providing you with update rollups. So cumulative updates basically replace the update rollups, and update rollups were really just a collection of fixes, whereas cumulative updates is the entire product. So every time you install a CU, setup is actually removing the product from the server and then reinstalling the updated version that you're running setup from. A service pack is identical to a CU. The only difference is we pick a specific CU to call it a service pack so that we can align with our product lifecycle. So if you're familiar with how we do our product life cycles. You know, we've got a 10-year support for every product that we have. And so this is how we map to the product life cycle. So there's really no difference between a cumulative update and a service pack. And so things get validated for on-premises delivery. In fact, we just did that a little bit more than a month ago with the latest cumulative updates for both Exchange 2016 and 2013. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And in fact, you can see when we deliver some of these things, like for instance, CU3 for 2016 included a new contact and calendaring experience for on-premises that maps, that actually matches, it's the same code of what we've been doing in Exchange Online for some time. So here's where we are with the 2016 lifecycle. Again, I said I was gonna primarily focus on these versions. So 2016's been out for a little bit more than a year, came out in the end of September last year, and then since then, after RTM, we had the GA, which is when it became generally available and people could download it worldwide. And then since then, we've had three CUs, three cumulative updates, 1, 2, and 3, the last one coming out, like I said, just about a month ago, a little bit more than a month ago. All right, so for those of you who have seen how a cumulative update works, and that could be in 2016 or 2013, there is a change that we've made in the 2016 code branch, and that change is in CU3, and it basically changes how setup operates with respect to managed availability. So if you're not familiar with it, managed availability is this automatic recovery feature that's built into Exchange 2013 and 2016. And when you run setup on an Exchange server in an upgrade mode, in other words, there's already a version there and you're upgrading to another CU, when you do that historically, as soon as you ran setup, setup would stop the managed availability features, basically put into a server-wide offline monitoring state. And then it would do a prereq check and it would go ahead and tell you if the prereqs were there and then proceed with install if they were. Now what we do is we've actually changed the behavior in CU3 so that we actually don't put the server into maintenance mode until after the prerequisites have been validated. So that is it's a minor change in behavior, but it's important for especially those administrators who are running setup from a GUI so that they can feel confident that the server is still on and operational from a managed availability standpoint before they actually click continue to go ahead with setup. Once the prereq phase is done, setup will just go ahead and do its thing. And the change is the same, by the way, for both the GUI and the command line install. The difference being that the command line install gives you a key to press if you want to pause it versus a button you have to click, the install button in the GUI. All right, some other changes that we did. You may have noticed that earlier releases of Exchange were much, much smaller, but in fact they weren't. It was really just a packing mechanism that changed things. So for those of you who have still, for those of you who are still on Exchange 2013, you're still downloading a self-extracting executable. But for 2016, what we've done is we've changed our production build process so that we now use ISOs. And the reason for this is when we build Exchange, when we actually run the build process and create the Exchange binaries that we end up shipping to you, we have to copy them from the build system onto a release server. And what we found is when it was an EXE in a certain format, that could take as long as 20 minutes for that copying to happen in the build process. So what we did was we refactored the build. We broke out some of the features like search, fast being its name. We also added a lot of new languages, and we also have a bunch of new tiny files that go with Outlook on the Web, which is the new name for Outlook Web App. And in doing that, what we found by changing the build from just these individual files being copied over to an ISO being copied over, it went from 20 minutes down to 54 seconds. Okay, so that is literally the reason you now get to download a very large ISO versus a much smaller EXE because we changed that in the build process. All right. So let's start with what you need to do to get up to speed for deploying and managing Exchange. The first thing you want to become familiar with is this Exchange Server Supportability Matrix. This is the one central source where you can go to that tells you about all of these supported configurations for various versions of Exchange, not just Exchange Online in 2016, but 2013, 2010, et cetera. All supported versions of Exchange and their clients. If you have not seen this, there's the shortcut URL up at the top. I would strongly recommend going to visit this website and just making sure that you have everything the way it should be. Because this is, in fact, our support statement with respect to on-premises Exchange. Just a quick side note, I do see some of you taking pictures of the screen, and that's totally fine. Feel free to do that as much as you want. But this is being recorded, and the slides will be available for download later on. I would encourage you strongly to download the slides, because for this particular session, I always pack a lot of extra stuff in the notes, and you're going to want to get that as far as the download. All right. Now, the supportability matrix also helps you determine, you know, what's our servicing model, and do I have to download cumulative updates, do I have to do update roll-ups, and again, it's going to depend on the version of Exchange that you're on. The only packages we'll deliver separately are security updates. Those will not require you to deploy a full CU or update roll-up. We will give those to you separately. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that we are right now tracking an issue where if you're on a certain CU and you have a security update installed, the next CU will not install until you remove the security update. It shouldn't operate that way, but that's how it is now, but it's something that we're tracking and looking into. The other thing I would point out is this also covers our operating system support here as well. I know it's sort of bleached out where you can't see the lines, but again, when you get the slides, there's lines in a table format for you. So this tells you what operating systems are supported with what version of Exchange, and then everywhere you see that little one in superscript, that means it's a management tools only installation that's supported. Can't deploy the server, but you can put the management tools on there. All right. Now, as you can see, we have added Windows Server 2016 down at the bottom there, because in fact, that is supported in production as long as you are running Exchange 2016 as well. So Exchange 2016 CU3 and later is required if you want to run Windows Server 2016 on your Exchange servers. There's no way around that. You do also need to raise your forest functional level up to Windows 2008 R2 or later. If you're already at that level, there's really nothing that you need to do. But if you're not at that level, we need you to be there for some of the new features that are in there. Now, there are a slew of new features in Windows Server 2016, and Exchange does not take advantage of any of them. However, there is one benefit that you get, because they have changed Windows Installer and the Trusted Installer mechanism in Windows 2016 such that it no longer requires you to reboot after installing some of the operating system prerequisites like IIS, etc. So now you can actually run setup, have it do a prereq check, and if any of the base prereqs are missing, you can literally install them and then just click retry and setup, and it will see that they're there now and no reboot will be required. Pretty much the only external dependency you would need now on Windows 2016 is the UCMA, which is required for unified messaging, which even if you're not using that, you still have to install it on your servers because it's part of the requirements for that. Now, if you want to go to Windows 2016, the only way to get there is a fresh, brand new install, because as with the before, you can't upgrade the operating system on an existing Exchange server. There's no upgrading the OS when Exchange is on the box. You can remove Exchange and then upgrade the OS and then re-add Exchange, but I would suggest that if you're going to do that, you might as well flatten the OS as well and start fresh. You also can't use the recover server switch to change operating systems as part of a disaster recover operation. So again, new installs are the only way to get there. And if you do go down this route, they made a change in Windows 2016 so that Windows Defender is now enabled by default. And on an Exchange server, there are certain things we don't want Windows Defender to interfere with. And so that would be things like the setup log, and not just Windows Defender, but any antivirus software that you have. And then the node runner processes, which are the, you'll see four of them on an Exchange server. Those are for the search components of Exchange. So those have to be excluded from scanning, from Defender, any antivirus software. Otherwise, there will be known interferences that will affect the functionality of Exchange. Now, net framework support, that has also changed recently, and it's continuing to change as we get into next year as well. So If you do want to run Exchange 2016 CU3 on Windows 2016, you do need to run .NET 4.6.2. But if you're not running in that platform, then 4.6.1 is the latest version that you can have. That's the latest version we'll support with that. There are also some post-release fixes that are needed for 4.6.1 as well. So it's not just going and grabbing .NET and installing that. There's some other fixes that you need. And again, download the slides and you'll find the URLs for those fixes in the notes. The only other thing that we would say is if you are on a previous version of .NET and you're also upgrading to a newer CU on Exchange, do the CU upgrade first and then do .NET after that. That's the order in which we test, and that's the order in which we support. The other thing to be aware of is if you uninstall or reinstall .NET on an Exchange server, it's going to be different on other servers, but on an Exchange server, if you do this, then you'll actually have to recompile the .NET assemblies. And there's a couple different scripts you can get. One is a WSF file, the other is a PowerShell script, and you'll run both of those. They are posted now on GitHub. We used to have them on MSDN, but actually today, literally like 4 hours ago, we moved them over to GitHub. But the URLs still point to where they are now. So you'll want to go down and grab that and run those scripts after you've uninstalled the .NET framework. The other thing about support is with the Windows Management Framework. So that's remote management plus PowerShell. So Exchange 2016 is only going to be supporting the version of Windows Management Framework that ships in the operating system. And moving forward, we're only going to support the latest version of WMF that comes with the latest version of the operating system. So what that means is it's actually more convenient for you because you don't have to download standalone or down-level versions and do a manual install. It's built into the operating system, and Exchange Setup can go ahead and add that to the box for you. But keep that in mind, earlier versions are not going to be supported on Exchange servers. Now, the other thing that you want to do is when you're ready to deploy, we've got this wonderful tool called the Exchange Server Deployment Assistant. It's a web-based tool, so you go to the website, you choose one of these scenarios. Are you doing on-prem? Are you doing a hybrid? Are you coming from 2010, 2013, et cetera, et cetera? You answer a few questions, and it will generate for you a custom step-by-step set of instructions so that you can actually do the deployment in your organization. And it's not just about installing the servers. It's about configuring mail flow, certificates, internet routing, et cetera, et cetera. It also has features if you're optionally deploying an Edge transport server, we can help you with that. And we can also help you with public folder migrations, all in this. It is web-based, but it's a very smart web-based application. So it has some persistence logic in it, which means you could go through the deployment assistant and close the web browser, and when you go back and restart it, you're back right where you left off. So we will recognize that. You do also have an option to start over if you need, but for convenience, you'll be right where you left off. This would be the best tool for anybody to run who's deploying an Exchange server, whether or not you have experience deploying Exchange. Because this, like I said, will give you all the steps that we require you to do in order to get a functioning and supported Exchange server in your environment. So here's the top half of the page. Here's the bottom half of the page. You can see we've got lots, pretty much every scenario covered that you can imagine for deploying Exchange, anywhere from a new deployment to upgrades to hybrid and so forth. And when you do deploy, we also want you to deploy what we call the preferred architecture. And the preferred architecture is an architecture that very closely maps to how we deploy Exchange in Office 365. So things like a database availability group and putting multiple databases on the same storage volume. All of those are best practices from the Exchange engineering team, and in fact, all of those are things that we do in the service as well. So it is specifically designed to increase availability, reduce complexity, and reduce costs for your messaging system. So we introduced the preferred architecture with 2013, so hopefully all of you who raised your hand who are running 2013 are running in that architecture. If not, I would go have a look at the preferred architecture and see if you can snap yourself to it, or if you have legitimate business reasons for having exceptions to the architecture. This is not a support requirement. We don't force you to do that, but this is how we would deploy it if you said, hey, come on over and deploy our Exchange servers for us. So this is really what we want all customers to do. And then to help you with that, we also have this Exchange Server Role Requirements Calculator. And we've actually combined the Exchange 2013 and 2016 calculator into one. So you can just go down, download the one Excel calculator, and you could come up with the architecture for both versions of Exchange. So that's why, for instance, you see Exchange 2013 listed up here a bunch of times. But this calculator is for 2013 and 2016. It also does have some new features. If you used it previously but haven't used it recently, we have a whole bunch of new features, including tabs that allow you to simulate failover in your environment. You can push a button, fail a site, and it will show you how your databases will be activated. The other thing it will do for you is there's buttons where after you do have the configuration the way you want it, you push a button and it will create the PowerShell scripts that you'll need to run in order to do the deployment. So that will substantially reduce the amount of time it takes you to actually get the servers built and into production. So if you haven't used the calculator in a while, I would strongly recommend checking it out again. We are always doing updates to it. And in fact, when we release updates to Exchange, sometimes they require updates to the calculator. As an example, in CU3 for 2016, we finally introduced what we call read from passive. And what that means is that the content indexer on a passive node will now do the indexing from the passive database. We won't send it from the active copy over the network to the passive copies anymore. As a result of that change, that results in a fairly significant bandwidth savings for you. So because of that, we had to change some of the formulas in the calculator to account for that. So keep that in mind. There are some times where we'll introduce a CU and you'll want to go get a new version of the calculator to work with some of the new features. All right, that's the basics. Let's talk about some HA stuff. How many of you have a DAG deployed? All right. How many of you don't have a DAG deployed? Okay, you guys can leave. I'll wait. No, I'm kidding. You really should have a DAG. If you're not running on a DAG, if you don't have high availability, it's something we strongly feel that you should look at, because I think everybody knows email is beyond mission critical for businesses. And if email goes down, business processes can stop. You can result in lost opportunities and all sorts of calamity. So I definitely recommend HA. But when you're doing HA, you're going to want to watch out for a couple things. So for instance, we have this feature called auto reseed. And this is a perfect example of a feature that was created in the service in Exchange Online and then shipped to on-premises because it's just so valuable. And for us, we would not really be able to run the service without auto reseed. If you don't know what this feature does, basically, when a disk dies in the service, we don't use any RAID, and the preferred architecture doesn't use any RAID. So everything is JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And now in the 2016 preferred architecture, we want you to store multiple databases on that one non-rated disk, and their log files and the index files. So literally the opposite of what we told you to do like 20 years ago. So auto reseed, if a disk fails, auto reseed will automatically grab a spare that's been put in the box, it will format that spare, and then we'll kick off a reseeding of the databases that were on the failed disk. And that's something, like I said, we need in the service, because given the sheer scale of our service, disks die all the time. Not because we buy bad ones, just because we buy so many, we see the general average failure rate anywhere from 2.75 to 3.5%. And what that means is, on a daily basis, multiple disks are dying somewhere in data centers around the world. And if we had to send an operator, which is what we call an administrator in the service, if we had to send an operator out to fix that, that'd be a very manual process, and it'd be a very expensive process as well. So now our build includes a couple extra spare drives. We use two. We used to use three, but we got down to two now in the service. So when we build our servers, we put two spare drives in them, and we configure auto reseed, and auto reseed will automatically take care of replacing the drive and the affected databases for us. Now, we also use BitLocker. I hope everyone is familiar with that. It's the volume encryption feature that is built into Windows Server. And BitLocker is there so that we can have a baseline of encrypting your data at rest. So one of the challenges that we had is we just changed the process in CU2 for how you manage BitLocker. And in fact, we released this blog that gave you step-by-step instructions on how to deploy BitLocker in a DAG. Now, the problem is, though, if you followed all those steps, auto-receipt actually still won't be able to work in the BitLocker environment because of how we implemented this property, auto-DAG, BitLocker enabled. The thing with auto-receipt, it's not just a feature that came from the service. The actual configuration that you have to do on-premises has to match the configuration we have in the service. Auto-receipt is hard-coded with certain requirements. This, unfortunately, was an unintended hard-coded requirement. And because of that, because of the way this property is implemented, it's expecting things that are in the service that simply aren't there in on-premises, and as a result of that, auto-receipt and BitLocker are not working well together. So the good news is we do have a temporary solution. It's a bit of a headache, but it does require using a BitLocker data recovery agent or copying certificates around to DAG members. But we do have plans to have a more permanent fix for this in a upcoming CU for both 2013 and 2016. The other thing about auto-receipt is we support more than one file system in a DAG. We support both NTFS and REFS, the resilient file system. And auto-receipt can actually be given instructions to format for either file system depending on what you're using. Now, auto-receipt will only format quarantined disks, and disks become quarantined if they are simply not readable from an operating system standpoint. If a disk is totally bad, auto-receipt will ignore it, but if a disk maybe had some problems but is actually okay, then auto-receipt will check every 24 hours to see if it's viable to be formatted. Now, if it finds a disk that is already formatted in quarantine, it will reformat it using the same file system that that disk has. So if the disk is REFS, auto-receipt will format REFS. If it's NTFS, it'll do that instead. But you can actually configure at the DAG level a property so that you can set auto-receipt to format to REFS, even if you are moving away from NTFS. And typically that's what you need to do, because if auto-receipt sees a quarantine NTFS disk, it's going to reformat it NTFS, even though you might want to move to REFS. So keep that in mind. There's a file system property that you can set for the DAG, and when you do that, auto-receipt will honor that and use that for the file format. Now, another thing that we introduced, this was in 2016 CU2, it's called the preference move frequency property. Prior to this property being introduced, administrators used to have to run this script called redistribute active databases. And this was a script that would go and look at your DAG and rebalance the databases according to your activation preference values. The downside to that script was it either needed to be run manually, ad hoc by an administrator, or through a scheduled task. And the scheduled task, we made it very easy. You could literally copy and paste it off a blog and put it in the task schedule on your server. But we've done away with the scheduled task. With CU2, we now have the preference move frequency property, and this is how frequently you want the DAG to look at the activation preference of the databases and do a rebalancing. Now, this does have a couple issues, though. So the default value is 1 hour, but if you do get DAG, it's going to report the value as null. That's something that we're fixing. The other thing is the way in which you would disable it using the time span ::0, which is how you disable a lot of features, that actually doesn't work because the code will treat that now as an error condition and simply ignore when you try to do that. So really the only way to do it is to set it to that value down below, the system.threading value, and then restart the replication service on all DAG members. So it is a bit intrusive to do this. And again, both of these things are things that we're fixing in upcoming CUs. In fact, this particular fix got done like a week before we shipped CU3, so it was just too late to get it into CU3, so I fully expect the fix for this to be in CU4. All right, let's talk about some transport stuff. How many of you have a requirement for email address internationalization? In other words, non-ASCII names or characters, rather, in the user portion or the domain name of the mail address. Anybody? No one. Okay, well, If you do, in the future, just be aware that we have supported it for quite some time, but there are still some scenarios that we don't have covered, and you can see that those are coming later on. So if you're not familiar what it looks like, here's a couple examples where up at the top we're showing it for the username. That actually says username at domain.com. The domain.com's in Russian. And then over here you see user at domain.com, and the word user is in Russian as well. So that's what we're talking about when we say EAI and non-ASCII characters. Actually, this says it should be finished up deploying very soon. Actually, I think at this point we are done. We have rolled it out worldwide throughout Exchange Online, so I'll correct that slide. All right, anti-spoofing. For many months now, we have seen a massive increase in targeted spear phishing attacks. Spear phishing is like regular phishing, trying to fool someone into doing something for malicious purposes, but spear phishing is targeted. You're actually targeting important individuals at a particular company, like the CEO, the CFO, the CIO, or maybe an administrator, someone with elevation or power or credentials and so forth. And we see a lot of mails that look like this. You know, it looks like a very simple mail. It looks like it's coming from internally. It doesn't have any grammar or spelling errors. It looks very legitimate, except that this is completely bogus. This is not sent by Rudy to Tom, who's the CFO, who could release those funds. This is a spear phishing email. In fact, this is very close to an actual spear phishing campaign that attacked a large United States bank. Now, because these messages are sent in very low volume and they're targeted, and because they look so legitimate, again, no spelling or grammar errors, and the recipient is typically not aware that they're being targeted with a malicious message. So this can cause a lot of damage, and in particular, a lot of financial damage, as in the case here. Now, EOP itself already has anti-spoofing technology back in. SPF, DKIM, the domain keys, DMARC, and so forth. But what we're finding is many organizations simply don't have the expertise to set up all this stuff to prevent their own domains from being spoofed. So what we're done is a few months ago, we rolled out this feature called Exact Domain Spear Phishing Protection, or what we call Business Email Compromise. And this is going to enable Exchange Online and Exchange Online Protection to detect spoofing of your domain, even if you don't have any of the other anti-spoofing features set up. So if you haven't done anything with SPF or DKIM or DMARC and so forth, we now still will protect you against basic domain spear phishing and basic domain spoofing for free, and it's automatic. There's nothing that you have to do to get it. Everybody's getting it. In fact, everybody has it. So what you can do right now, you can certainly go in to the admin center and customize the features, make it more granular, or loosen up restrictions if it ends up being too tight for you. But right now, it is out there and protecting you in Exchange Online. Now, one challenge is that mailing lists can be a source of false positives, and that's simply because of the way they're routed. So there's this authentication receive chain feature that we're going to be building into Exchange Online and Office 365 once that standard has been finalized and approved. We actually are one of the organizations that are involved in creating the standard, and we've already said publicly many times that we are going to enhance and embrace it as part of anti-spoofing. Some other things that are coming up, we're changing the default way that we do email relay in Exchange Online and Exchange Online Protection. So if your organization has any of these three requirements, if you have to send NDRs to internet recipients and relay them through Office 365, if you have to send messages to an on-premises email server, to Office 365 domains that are not your own, so other customers, tenants, or if you have a forwarding rule that goes from on-premises and relayed through Office 365. Effective February 1st, those things will not work anymore. We're changing the default out-of-box behavior. Now, you can still get them to work, but you have to go ahead and do things yourself to set it up, like create a connector and instruct the service to use a certificate to authenticate the emails coming from your organization, your on-premises environment, and then your on-premises environment also needs to be configured with the same certificates in order to complete the TLS channel, And the certificate has to be signed and contain the name within the subject alternative name of a domain that is authoritative for you in Office 365 as well. If you do all those things, then any of the scenarios I talked about on the previous slide will start working for you again. But this is, again, just another way we're trying to tighten up the controls to provide a protected environment. Now, another thing that's coming very quickly is we are deprecating the smart screen technology inside of Outlook and Exchange. This is actually very old technology. It was, I think, first introduced with Exchange 2003 SP2 as part of the IMF, the Intelligent Message Filter. And basically the way it works is the kind of the same way almost all anti-spam works. It'll evaluate a message, assign a spam confidence level to it, filter it, examine it, and then and pass it through. Now, smart screen in Exchange and Outlook is somewhat obsolete and out of date, and it's very, very behind what we can do in Exchange Online Protection. And so we're deprecating in favor of folks using EOP for mail filtering. And EOP, you don't have to be in the cloud to use it. You can have all on-premises Exchange servers and still use EOP as a cloud filtering service for you. So effective November 1st, we're gonna stop updating the smart screen definition. So Exchange will stop receiving them automatically and Outlook will stop receiving them automatically. Eventually, we will also remove smart screen completely from both products. Until then, like I said, we're not going to have definitions out there anymore, and so what that means is the existing ones are going to be left in place, and they will continue to provide some level of protection, but that protection is going to diminish increasingly over time as they'll be frozen. Outlook's junk email options are not changing. Those are still going to be the same, so all the behaviors that you're used to there will still be there. The other thing I want to point out is in Windows and in Microsoft Edge web browser and in Internet Explorer, we also use technology called Smart Screen to protect you against malicious websites and malicious downloads. That is continuing. The only thing that they have in common between the Exchange and Outlook one and the Windows and browser stuff is branding. They just share the same name. So Windows, IE, and Edge are going to stay and they'll continue to receive updates. It's only the smart screen implementation in Outlook and Exchange that is going away. All right, here's some things to watch out for. How many of you have heard of modern authentication, also known as OAuth? All right, so OAuth is almost fully deployed across all of Office 365. We're just short a couple things, namely PowerShell for Exchange Online and PowerShell for SharePoint Online. The only other coverage we don't have would be the Skype for Business client on Mac OS X and on Windows Phone 10. Otherwise, everywhere else in the service is now using OAuth. And the instructions to configure it are very easy and they're out there. And like so many instructions, because they're designed for Exchange, which is the same code between online and on-premises, some customers have mistakenly thought that I can use these instructions to enable modern auth in my on-premises environment. So this watch out is basically saying, don't do that. And first, you will break Outlook for the Mac. But even if you don't run Outlook for the Mac, it's still gonna break other things, and it's not supported, and it's not even fully baked in the on-premises product. So don't try to do that because it's not going to work at all for you. Now, public folders. How many of you have public folders? All right, most of the room, good. So there is a challenge that we have, and this is both on 2013 and 2016, where Outlook 2016 can have a problem connecting to legacy public folders, not the new modern ones, but legacy public folders, because of a mistake in the auto discover response that it has. So Outlook 2016 made a change that now requires that the public folder information section of the auto discover response XML file has to point to a public folder discovery mailbox that's on the same server as the public folder database property of the user's mailbox. And there's actually a script you can run, go to that URL and you can download that script and it will go through and stamp the correct value for that on all of your servers and basically fix this problem for you. The other thing that you want to do is if you have a combo of Exchange 2013 and 2016 in your organization, you want to make sure that the primary hierarchy mailbox for modern public folders is on the later version, points to 2016. You don't want it to point to 2013 or things will break. So for instance, Outlook web app in 2013 won't be able to access them. The other thing right now with public folder hierarchy sync emails, those are getting captured by the journaling process. So if you are using journaling in your environment, you are going to see these replication sync messages get into your journal mailbox, and you're free to go in and delete them. That won't harm anything. But for right now, that is happening, and we do expect that to be fixed in CU4. The workaround would be to disable journaling and use a transport rule, but I fully understand that is not a tenable workaround for everybody who's going to be in this situation. Something else to watch out for, how many of you have deployed in a parent-child domain? Okay, not too many. It is a supported scenario where you've got Exchange in a parent domain and users in a child domain, but in that case, when you use the GUI, the Exchange Admin Center, to import or export PSTs, it actually will break in this environment. Now, we've had a bug open for this for a very long time, but we're not going to fix it. And the reason we're not going to fix it is because there's a very simple and easy workaround. You just add the domain controller parameter, specify DC in the child domain, and the problem is completely gone. So because it's such a simple and easy workaround, this bug is going to be in there and not going to be fixed. So just keep that in mind. Now, we also introduced, when we shipped 2016 for SharePoint and Exchange, a few months later after that, we also introduced this Office Online Server. And this is the server that allows you to do Word, PowerPoint, Excel, et cetera, through your web browser without having the rich client installed. I won't harp too much on the prerequisites. That's really just in there for those of you who might not be familiar with it. But I do want to point out that if you do have Exchange 2013 in the environment with 2016, and you are using the Office Online Server, so for instance, users can preview Office files within the Outlook on the Web experience, again, Outlook on the Web being the new name for Outlook Web App, you cannot configure the OOS, or the Office Online Servers, to point to 2013, because OOS is not supported with 2013. It's only supported with the 2016 features. The other thing that if you want users outside of your organization to be able to log into Outlook on the Web and preview these files, you do have to open up 443 for the Office Online Server as well and make that reachable through the internet. And then the only other issue there is if you have any attachments that are in an email message that's encrypted using S/MIME, you won't be able to see them because Outlook on the Web won't be able to render them. It's not supported yet by OOS. All right, we talked a little bit about modern authentication. Let's talk about one more thing that we're seeing happen quite frequently. So the way OAuth works is when you install an Exchange server, it generates a new certificate for OAuth to use for authentication, and then the Microsoft Exchange service host goes and it takes that certificate and copies it to all the other Exchange servers that need it. Now, what we're finding is that a lot of customers are simply not paying any attention to the certificate, and worse, some of them are simply deleting it because they don't know what it is and they don't know how it's being used. When that happens, that will break OAuth authentication and it will break a lot of experiences like Exchange using the Office Online Server. So if that's the case in your environment, you'll see these events in the application event log. And if you don't see them, maybe your event log is cleared or you haven't looked or whatnot, you can also run a couple PowerShell scripts to tell you if the certificate is present or not. The one up at the top shows the certificate present. The one at the bottom shows that it's missing and there's a problem. If you do run this and you find the certificate is missing, or in fact, if you already know the certificate is missing, getting it back is super easy. You just run these two commands and it will recreate a new certificate, and then that certificate will be used for the OAuth authentication. All right, few odds and ends now. Okay, so back to public folders. We did recently increase our support stance around public folders, namely going to a million folders within 1,000 mailboxes in Exchange 2016, CU3 and later. And of course, we're talking about modern public folders, those that exist within mailbox databases, not legacy public folders in the public folder databases. We also right now are looking for customers that have a large number of public folders and want to move them to Office 365 or Exchange Online modern folders. And so if you want to participate, you can simply send an email address to them or send an email message to them and they'll give you all the information. We would love to have you help us out. And of course, we will be holding your hand the whole time you're doing a migration, and that's kind of a very cool advantage for customers moving from on-premises public folders to the cloud. All right, archived mailboxes. We kind of had this mantra for years that a mailbox is a mailbox is a mailbox is a mailbox, but the fact of the matter is they're not all completely treated equally, especially from a management standpoint. Now, with respect to a primary archive mailbox, the story is the same. If you delete them or if you mail disable them, it's not gone right away. There's a grace period during which it still exists in the database and can be recovered and reassigned to a user. We call those disconnected mailboxes. Now, in order to reconnect a mailbox, Exchange actually needs to know what mailboxes inside a database are available for reconnection. And it does that by periodically syncing the mailbox objects in the database with the corresponding objects in Active Directory. And that's how it determines what mailboxes are live and active and which ones are disconnected. And in fact, you could run getmailbox/soft-deleted-mailbox on premises or in Exchange Online, and they'll both show you all the disconnected mailboxes. Now, generally it's easy to reconnect a primary mailbox. You could do that through the Exchange Admin Center, so it's a very quick and easy GUI experience. But you cannot reconnect an archive mailbox using either the GUI or the same script at the top that you would use to connect a primary. Instead, you've got to do a couple things. First, you have to get the GUID of the mailbox, which you use Get Mailbox Statistics to do that. Once you get that, you simply pass that GUID to Enable Mailbox, and that re-enables it and reconnects up the mailbox the way you want. So keep that in mind. Mailboxes largely are the same, but dealing with disconnected archives versus disconnected primaries is a completely different experience. All right, here's a quick one. We get a lot of questions like, how can I tell what security credentials I'm using inside of PowerShell? I'm a consultant, and I often have 4 or 5 PowerShell windows open for different clients. So how do I know who I am? Well, you can actually do it a couple different ways. You could do a who am I, but here's another way to do it right here in the session context. And then there's 2 more ways that I put in the notes as well. So when you, again, download the slide deck, you can see a bunch of different ways to do that. Some you can just display ad hoc in the output itself. Others you can actually have written to the title of the PowerShell window. So you've got a lot of different choices there. All right, the last few things I want to talk about are very new things that we were working on for quite some time. And they're all designed to increase security for our cloud customers and to demonstrate our commitment to transparency with respect to how we run the service. So the first thing I want to talk about is this thing called Secure Score. It actually says preview, but that's a mistake. We have released it now, and you can go check it out. So Secure Score is kind of like a credit score. Okay, it looks at your initial configuration and then gives you a score, not just based on the configuration, but based on how other organizations that are similar to yours have also configured and secured their environments. So it's not just a comparison against the security baseline, it's also a comparison of other similarly situated customers. Now, it's not an absolute measure of how secure you are. It's not intended to be used as a likelihood or non-likelihood of any breach. It really just is a way to express the extent to which you have adopted the security controls we have in the cloud for you to defend and prevent breaches. So no service can guarantee that you can't be breached. Secure Score's not doing that. I'm not doing that. Microsoft's not doing that. Office 365's not doing that. There's no guarantees. But we're trying to give you a way in which you can look at your environment and gauge how secure it is, again, based on the security profile of comparative organizations. It is implemented as a third-party application. So the first time that you run it, and you can run it by going to secureScore.office.com, you do have to accept it. And when you accept it, it will give you all the information. It will be able to rather read your directory information and run some scripts to do the scanning in your environment. So when you look at it and you say, yeah, go ahead, run, do your thing, it will give you a score right away. But if you look at the bottom, you're also gonna see where it says some actions are in the queue because it's an asynchronous run of the various scripts that are checking the settings for your tenant organization. So you may see an initial score that could increase or decrease depending on the outcome of whatever scripts are remaining to be run. So I would check this out if you have Exchange Online or an Office 365 tenant. Again, secureScore.office.com. It'll help you understand how to make your online environment a bit more secure than the default out-of-box settings. The other things I want to talk about are Service Assurance and the Service Trust Portal. So Service Assurance is an area inside of the Security and Compliance Center, which we used to call the Protection Center, so protection.office.com. Service Assurance is the one-stop portal where you can go to for all of our regulatory, compliance, risk, transparency, all sorts of different content and tools. Service Trust Portal is a third-party app. We developed it, our trust team developed it, but it's implemented as an Azure third-party app. And that's where if you only have an Azure or a CRM or an Intune account, but you don't have Office 365, you would want to go to the Service Trust Portal. If you have any of those things or you have Office 365, you're going to want to go to Service Assurance. So Service Trust Portal, this is what it looks like. You can see it's a very basic website. It's got two main areas. One area is the compliance reports. This is where you can find and actually download the reports for audits that are performed against our cloud services and our data centers by third-party independent auditors. So things like our ISO audit report you can get there, our SOC audit reports, and a whole bunch of other audit reports for regions around the world. The other thing that you can get there are these trust documents, which are typically white papers, but these are very deep dive white papers. You'll find in here details and information about how we run all the services in Office 365 that you won't find anywhere else. It's not on TechNet, not on MSDN, not on the Trust Center, nowhere. The only place you'll find this is either the Service Trust Portal, or we also mirror it inside the Service Assurance Dashboard, which is what you're seeing right now. So I do know, I think we have a couple more minutes, so I would like to actually break out of this and show you guys a quick live demo. So let me pull this up real quick. And I'll show you a couple of cool features that we have in the Service Assurance area. If you have to do anything whatsoever with risk or compliance or risk assurance, if you have to prove to your regulators that Office 365 is a secure cloud service, this is where you would go to get all that information. So I'll show it on the screen in a minute. I'm just logging in and I don't want you to see my credentials. So again, I'm just going to protection.office.com. I hadn't been logged in before, so it asked me for my Office 365 credentials, and I put those in, and now it's bringing up the dashboard for me. And Service Assurance is at the bottom here. A couple things I'll point out, though. There's this recommended for you box here up at the top. So one of the cool features that we have in Office 365 is called the Unified Audit Log, which is populated by data as a result of the Office 365 Management Activity API. So anything, any human, any software, any piece of code that touches tenant configuration, tenant data, or anything gets logged inside that audit report. If you don't have auditing enabled, up here in this box, it will say, click here to enable recording for activities in your domain. If you do have it enabled, like I do, you'll get this message that says, oh, search the audit log for whatever you're looking for. So that'll be a couple visual cues as to whether or not you're set up for that. So looking at the service assurance dashboard, this is really just kind of a home page for the features that are below it, namely compliance reports, trust documents, and audited controls. So again, the compliance reports, those are things like the actual auditing reports. So you could actually click on, for instance, ISO reports, and you could download the ISO reports, the actual audit reports from a third-party auditor against Azure, Dynamics CRM Online, MCIO, which stands for Microsoft Cloud Infrastructure and Operations. That is the Microsoft group that runs all of our data centers around the world. Office 365, of course, and Yammer as well. We had them done separately. The trust documents, like I mentioned, are FAQs, white papers. There's also in here an Excel spreadsheet called the Customer Security Considerations Workbook. If you have an Office 365 tenant, it's just worth it going to the site just for that workbook. It's an Excel workbook that you download, and it will tell you all the things that you need to consider from a security standpoint based on things like the threats or the risks and so forth. And then right in that spreadsheet, we also give you things like a link to where you can go and configure something in the portal to make it more secure, or the actual PowerShell script that you would want to enable or disable something depending on the security. And then the last thing I'll show you in here is this audited controls. So I mentioned, yes, we get audited. We're actually almost audited continuously because they're staggered for different standards. So generally at any given point, Microsoft and our data centers are being audited by some third party. What we've started doing is taking the actual controls that are being audited and publishing them into Service Assurance so that you can click on an audited control and not only see all of the individual controls based on the individual standard security domains. And when you click on one of them, you can see the number of the control, you can see the Office 365 internal controls that it maps to, so that's Microsoft's own internal GRC framework. But then we also show you the control implementation details. This is the same exact information we give the third-party auditors. And we also give you the testing details. So this is the exact information of what the third-party auditor actually did to validate and verify that this control exists and it's being properly managed by us in the cloud. You can also export this. You can do searches for individual controls. And as you saw, we just have two standards there now, ISO 27001 and ISO 27018. But we are working on the NIST standards, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. It's the United States U.S. Department of Commerce agency. That maps to a control in the United States called FedRAMP, which are controls that you have to have, an authority that to operate that you have to have in order to serve government customers. So the FedRAMP and slash NIST controls are coming next. And then after that, we'll have the SOC controls audited there. Now, we also know that many of you have your own internal control frameworks. So what's also coming is a feature that will allow you to take your control framework and import it into audited controls, and audited controls will map your framework to ours. So you'll have a very quick and easy glance as to all the controls within Office 365 that map to the controls that you need for your organization's compliance. So maybe you're a financial services institution, maybe you're an insurer, maybe you're in healthcare. Chances are you're in an industry that requires fairly strict regulation as to what you can and cannot do in cloud services. And this is one of the ways in which we're trying to not just be transparent, but give you tools that you can use to help you pass your audits and go through your company's own risk assessments. Okay. Let me switch back here. beginning. Yeah. Actually, that was the last slide. The next one is the survey slide. So any questions? All right. Well, then that's it. That's all I have for you. We'll get to the survey slide in a second. Please fill out your surveys and check this stuff out. Check out STP. Check out Service Assurance. Service Assurance is a superset. So STP, like I said, is really there if you don't have an Office 365 account. You don't have to pay for this either. You can go and spin up a trial account and have access to all of this information. So if all you're interested is in the audit reports or the white papers, but you don't have an Office 365 or cloud service account, go and create a trial one. It doesn't cost you anything. It'll go very quickly to set that up, and then you'll have full access into these portals to get this content. The only other thing I'd say is, yes, I want to reiterate, we are absolutely committed to continuing developing Exchange for on-premises deployments. So, and in fact, if you would like to be a part of that process, you can join our TAP program, and you'll get plugged into the bits, the CUs, and the server builds before we ship them, and you'll get the chance to run them in your own production environment with our assistance and provide feedback and validation for us. So if you've ever been interested in being kind of on the cutting edge of Exchange Server on premises, send David an email or visit that blog post and we'd love to have you join us. It's a very exciting program because you'll end up getting to see things first before anybody else. So I highly recommend that. And then the surveys. All right, that's it for me, thank you.